They were going faster. They had left the ground, she thought, flung off by the mountains as by a springboard. They were now sailing through space. It's not a fair test, she thought. We're not going to touch that bridge. She saw Reardon's face above her. She held his eyes, and her head leaned back, so that her face lay still on the air under his face. They heard a ringing blast of metal. They heard a drum roll under their feet. The diagonals of the bridge went smearing across the windows with the sound of a metal rod being run along the pickets of a fence. Then the windows were too suddenly clear. The sweep of their downward plunge was carrying them up a hill. The derricks of Wyatt Oil were reeling before them. Pat Logan turned, glancing up at Reardon with the hint of a smile, and Reardon said, "That's that." The sign on the edge of a roof read, "Wyatt Junction." She stared, feeling that there was something odd about it, until she grasped what it was. The sign did not move. The sharpest jolt of the journey was the realization that the engine stood still. She heard voices somewhere. She looked down and saw that there were people on the platform. Then the door of the cab was flung open. She knew that she had to be the first to descend, and she stepped to the edge. For the flash of an instant, she felt the slenderness of her own body, the lightness of standing full figure in a current of open air. She gripped the metal bars and started down the ladder. She was halfway down when she felt the palms of a man's hands slammed tight against her ribs and waistline. She was torn off the steps, swung through the air, and deposited on the ground. She could not believe that the young boy laughing in her face was Ellis Wyatt. The tense, scornful face she remembered now had the purity, the eagerness, the joyous benevolence of a child in the kind of world for which he had been intended. She was leaning against his shoulder, feeling unsteady on the motionless ground, with his arm about her. She was laughing. She was listening to the things he said. She was answering, "But didn't you know we would?" In a moment she saw the faces around them. They were the bondholders of the John Galt line, the men who were Nielsen Motors, Hammond Cars, Stockton Foundry, and all the others. She shook their hands, and there were no speeches. She stood against Ellis Wyatt, sagging a little, brushing her hair away from her eyes, leaving smudges of soot on her forehead. She shook the hands of the men of the train's crew without words, with the seal of the grins on their faces. There were flashbulbs exploding around them, and men waving to them from the riggings of the oil wells on the slopes of the mountains. Above her head, above the heads of the crowd, the letters TT on a silver shield were hit by the last rays of a sinking sun. Ellis Wyatt had taken charge. He was leading her somewhere, the sweep of his arm cutting a path for them through the crowd, when one of the men with the cameras broke through to her side. "Miss Taggart," he called, "will you give us a message for the public?" Ellis Wyatt pointed at the long string of freight cars. "She has." Then she was sitting in the back seat of an open car driving up the curves of a mountain road. The man beside her was Reardon. The driver was Ellis Wyatt. They stopped at a house that stood on the edge of a cliff with no other habitation anywhere in sight, with the whole of the oil field spread on the slopes below. "Why, of course you're staying at my house overnight, both of you," said Ellis Wyatt as they went in. "Where did you expect to stay?" She laughed. "I don't know. I hadn't thought of it at all. The nearest town is an hour's drive away. That's where your crew has gone. Your boys at the division point are giving a party in their honor. So is the whole town. But I told Ted Nielsen and the others that we'd have no banquets for you and no oratory. Unless you'd like it." "God, no," she said. "Thanks, Ellis." It was dark when they sat at the dinner table in a room that had large windows and a few pieces of costly furniture. The dinner was served by a silent figure in a white jacket, the only other inhabitant of the house, an elderly Indian with a stony face and a courteous manner. A few points of fire were scattered through the room, running over and out beyond the windows, the candles on the table, the lights on the derricks, and the stars. "Do you think that you have your hands full now?" Ellis Wyatt was saying. "Just give me a year and I'll give you something to keep you busy. 2 tank trains a day, Dagny? It's going to be 4 or 6 or as many as you wish me to fill." His hands swept over the lights on the mountains. "This, it's nothing compared to what I've got coming." He pointed west. "The Buena Esperanza Pass, 5 miles from here. Everybody's wondering what I'm doing with it. Oil shale. How many years ago was it that they gave up trying to get oil from shale because it was too expensive? Well, wait till you see the process I've developed. It will be the cheapest oil ever to splash in their faces, and an unlimited supply of it, an untapped supply that will make the biggest oil pool look like a mud puddle. Did I order a pipeline? Hank, you and I will have to build pipelines in all directions, too. Oh, I beg your pardon. I don't believe I introduced myself when I spoke to you at the station. I haven't even told you my name. Reardon grinned. I've guessed it by now. I'm sorry, I don't like to be careless, but I was too excited. What were you excited about? Asked Agnew. Her eyes narrowed in mockery. Wyatt held her glance for a moment. His answer had a tone of solemn intensity, strangely conveyed by a smiling voice. About the most beautiful slap in the face I ever got and deserved. Do you mean for our first meeting? I mean for our first meeting. Don't. You were right. I was. About everything but you. Dagny, to find an exception after years of... Oh, to hell with them. Do you want me to turn on the radio and hear what they're saying about the two of you tonight? No. Good. I don't want to hear them. Let them swallow their own speeches. They're all climbing on the bandwagon now. We're the band. He glanced at Reardon. What are you smiling at? I've always been curious to see what you're like. I've never had a chance to be what I'm like, except tonight. Do you live here alone like this, miles away from everything? Wyatt pointed at the window. I'm a couple of steps away from everything. What about people? I have guest rooms for the kind of people who come to see me on business. I want as many miles as possible between myself and all the other kinds. He leaned forward to refill their wine glasses. Hank, why don't you move to Colorado? To hell with New York and the Eastern Seaboard. This is the capital of the Renaissance. The second Renaissance, not of oil paintings and cathedrals, but of oil derricks, power plants, and motors made of Reardon metal. They have the Stone Age and the Iron Age, and now they're going to call it the Reardon Metal Age, because there's no limit to what your metal has made possible. I'm going to buy a few square miles of Pennsylvania, said Reardon. The ones around my mills. It would have been cheaper to build a branch here as I wanted, but you know why I can't. And to hell with them, I'll beat them anyway. I'm going to expand the mills, and if she can give me 3-day freight service to Colorado, I'll give you a race for who's going to be the capital of the Renaissance. Give me a year, said Dagny, of running trains on the John Galt line. Give me time to pull the Taggart system together, and I'll give you 3-day freight service across the continent on a Reardon metal track from ocean to ocean. Who was it that said he needed a fulcrum? Said Ellis Wyatt. Give me an unobstructed right-of-way, and I'll show them how to move the earth. She wondered what it was that she liked about the sound of Wyatt's laughter. Their voices, even her own, had a tone she had never heard before. When they rose from the table, she was astonished to notice that the candles were the only illumination of the room. She had felt as if she were sitting in a violent light. Ellis Wyatt picked up his glass, looked at their faces, and said, To the world as it seems to be right now. He emptied the glass with a single movement. She heard the crash of the glass against the wall in the same instant that she saw a circling current, from the curve of his body to the sweep of his arm to the terrible violence of his hand that flung the glass across the room. It was not the conventional gesture meant as celebration. It was the gesture of a rebellious anger, the vicious gesture which his movement substituted for a scream of pain. Ellis, she whispered, what's the matter? He turned to look at her. With the same violent suddenness, his eyes were clear, his face was calm. What frightened her was seeing him smile gently. I'm sorry, he said. Never mind. We'll try to think that it will last. The earth below was streaked with moonlight when Wyatt led them up an outside stairway to the second floor of the house, to the open gallery at the doors of the guest rooms. He wished them good night, and they heard his steps descending the stairs. The moonlight seemed to drain sound as it drained color. The steps rolled into a distant past, and when they died, the silence had the quality of a solitude that had lasted for a long time, as if no person were left anywhere in reach. She did not turn to the door of her room. He did not move. At the level of their feet, there was nothing but a thin railing and a spread of space. Angular tiers descended below with shadows, repeating the steel tracery of derricks, crisscrossing sharp black lines on patches of glowing rock. A few lights, white and red, trembled in the clear air, like drops of rain caught on the edges of steel girders. Far in the distance, three small drops were green, strung in a line along the Taggart track. Beyond them, at the end of space, at the foot of a white curve, hung a webbed rectangle which was the bridge.